Cedar Rapids Gazette for March 16th, 2024, for Saturday. I'm your reader, Catherine Davis. Here's our first story. On the first page, there's the largest article is in the top left-hand corner. It's titled, Potato Party Distributes Tons of Veggies in Johnson County. There's a photo of a man in a pink shirt. He's bald. He is standing in front of a lot of crates of potatoes in what looks to be like a back room. It's captioned Mike Saeugling, I believe, S-A-E-U-G-L-I-N-G, of Iowa City stacks boxes of potatoes at Table to Table's warehouse in Iowa City on Friday. Table to Table received a donation of about 58,000 pounds of russet potatoes and called for volunteers to assist with their packing and distribution. Table to Table repackages largest donation in its history Friday in IC by Alejandro Rojas for the Gazette. Iowa City. A potato packing party hosted by Table to Table repackaged 18,000 pounds of the vegetables Friday afternoon. A fraction of the record-setting 58,000-pound donation this Iowa City nonprofit received this week. Table to Table has been collecting and redistributing surplus food in Johnson County since 1996. This week's donation of a semi-trailer of potatoes is the largest in its 28-year history. The donation started last week with the email from FarmLink, a table-to-table partner organization that recovers and transports food. It offered 20 pallet boxes of russet potatoes from Canada. After reaching out to their partners and learning they could use the potatoes, table-to-table accepted the offer. We know people really want them, and it's fresh produce, which is especially hard to get this time of year, said Nikki Ross, executive director of Table to Table. These potatoes, Ross said, were grown last season and had remained unsold. She said nothing is wrong with the produce, which she described as retail quality. The truckload is worth roughly $25,000. This article continues to page 8A. Ross said the donation had a dual purpose. For one, it gets potatoes to local organizations that help people in need, and for another, it diverts food from the landfill. Friday's donation is part of a new initiative the organization launched to capture unclaimed food from the food transportation industry, Ross said. She explained the organization previously didn't have the capacity or staffing to receive donations this large. The organization in recent years has increased staffing and moved into a location at 1049 U.S. Highway 6 East. Ross says they've also established a partnership with Lineage Logistics, a cold storage company in Iowa City that can receive donations on behalf of Table to Table. Marquise Heard, Marquise, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S, AmeriCorps local produce recovery coordinator with Table to Table, said a lot of coordination and planning went into receiving the large donation. The first part was determining how to receive the actual donations as they didn't have a vehicle large enough to transport the entire load. Then they had to plan out how to distribute the potatoes. Despite this challenge, Heard said he was excited to receive the donation. Being able to start talking on larger donations is really cool because I feel like we've kind of gotten really pretty good at collecting the food around here and in Johnson County, Heard said. So anytime we can take the opportunity to get food from somewhere else and help supply it is awesome. Staff from Table to Table and volunteers from United Way of Johnson and Washington counties and 5224 Good, about 20 people in all, helped move the potatoes from large pallet boxes to smaller boxes that will be sent to 43 other food access partner organizations in Johnson County. United Way volunteer Tom Banta said his wife told him about the opportunity to volunteer, and he decided to help. We're all blessed with certain things, and there's a lot of people that don't have a secure meal every night, he said. And so if this is going to help to give someone else that security going forward, then I'd love to be a part of that. But generally, it's just the right thing to do. Ann Suter was another volunteer working Friday afternoons. She said her family has been involved with Table to Table for years, and the work the organization does is important. I know lots and lots of people in the community are going to benefit from this, and that, you know, do your bit, help out, be a positive part of your community, and to help others out, she said. Of the 58,000 pounds of potatoes received, Ross said 18,000 pounds were packaged on Friday. Of those repackaged potatoes, the Coralville Food Pantry and the Hawkeye Area Community Action Program Food Reservoir, based in Hiawatha, received 6,000 and 9,000 pounds, respectively. Ross said the remaining potatoes will be packaged over the next few weeks. Volunteers from local organizations also arrived to pick up potatoes, including Emily Sinwell, co-founder of Iowa City Catholic Worker, in Ninoska, N-I-N-O-S-K-A, Campos, member of Escucha Mi Voz. Both with their organizations would be distributing the potatoes to those most in need. Allison Nade, programs and service member of Table to Table, said she was glad Table to Table was able to help local organizations with some of their needs. With the amount of potatoes on hand, Ross said, organizations were welcome to take as much as they wanted. Table to Table is planning to host produce stands so the public can pick up potatoes too. Ross said that plan isn't finished, so she doesn't know where the stands will be held. Regardless, she encouraged people to use these stands and to take home some potatoes. This is going to help to give someone else that security going forward, then I'd love to be a part of that. But generally, it's just the right thing to do. And on page 8, there are two more photographs. One is of two people, a man and a woman, standing under a tent outside, who are also working with the crates. They're like black crates filled with potatoes. It's captioned, Horatio Olivo of Iowa City sorts potatoes at Table to Table's work warehouse in Iowa City on Friday. Table to Table received a donation of thousands of pounds of potatoes and called for volunteers to assist with their packing and distribution. And then there's another photo of a gloved hand, being sort of held in front of two crates of potatoes. It's captioned, Emily Meister, Meister, maybe? M-E-I-S-T-E-R, of Iowa City, sorts potatoes at Table to Table's warehouse on Friday in Iowa City. Going back to the first page, there's a column article on the right in the upper-hand corner titled, Lawmakers Set Agenda for Final Weeks of 24 Session. AEA Bills... AEA bills, tax policy, school safety still to come this year, by Caleb McCullough, for the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines, after a key deadline passed this week in the Iowa legislature, narrowing the bills eligible for consideration, lawmakers are turning their attention to a smaller pool of legislation and beginning to work on tax and budget policy. This week was the second funnel week at the Capitol, where House bills needed to pass out of a Senate committee and vice versa, in order to remain alive for the rest of the session. Leaders have other tools to keep bills alive that have not met that requirement, though. While several high-profile bills died in committee this week, many others remain alive and will get more consideration in the coming weeks. Bills to reorganize the state's boards and commissions, change election deadlines, and regulate consumable hemp products are all among the bills that remain eligible for consideration. This article also continues to page 8. Friday marked the end of the session's 10th week. April 16th is the 100th day and the target end date for the session. though the session often goes longer than anticipated. The biggest piece of unfinished business on lawmakers' agenda is the proposal to overhaul the state's area education agencies, which provide special education support to school districts around the state. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed the bill at the beginning of the legislative session, but it has taken a winding path through the lawmaking process as it has met resistance even from lawmakers within her own party. Reynolds' initial proposal called for school districts to receive their full state and federal education in federal special education dollars. Rather than that funding being sent to the EAAs, the schools would then have the option to contract with the EAAs or a third party to provide education support for students with disabilities. The bill also would have directed funding for other education services that currently goes to the EAAs to school districts and cut a property tax stream that funds the AEA's media services. The bill also would have increased salaries for beginning and veteran teachers. After tabling Reynolds' proposal, House Republicans wrote their own plan to change the AEA's structure and oversight, keep AEAs as the sole provider of special education support, and phase in changes over a few years. House lawmakers passed that bill in February, but the Senate did not take it up for consideration. The Senate has passed an amended version of Reynolds' proposal out of a committee, but has not yet taken a floor vote on the bill. Lawmakers will need to bridge the significant gap between the two proposals in order to send a bill to Reynolds' desk to be signed into law. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican New Hartford, told reporters on Thursday that he has been having regular conversations with Senate leaders and the governor on the proposals. Right now, we're having good conversations, he said. We feel pretty strongly that whatever we do with AEAAs, we've been very clear in the House we wanted to continue to provide certainty for special ed parents and students in school districts. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Grimes, said his members have had a variety of concerns about the bill, but that he believes Senate Republicans are close to coming to a consensus. Our bill is vastly different than the governor's original bill. It's vastly different than the House, and so that's what makes it a little bit harder, he said. We've got to get our own bill off the floor, hopefully soon, to really start that conversation to see where it ends. Reynolds' House on Friday shared a Des Moines Register op-ed by two school superintendents arguing for changes to the AEA system. Reynolds has pointed to national test scores lagging behind other states to argue the AEA system is in need of reform. The system must provide transparency and accountability of school districts, those closest to our students, and drive consistency across the AEA regions to improve services for students with disabilities. Reynolds said when the House passed its bill, that's what I've heard from over 100 school districts as I've traveled the state, and I look forward to more conversations as the legislation moves forward. Democrats have repeatedly called for Republican lawmakers to slow down the proposal and form a task force to study this issue before making any major changes to the system. The proposal is complicated by the need for lawmakers to pass a bill setting the K-12 school funding level for the coming school year, which lawmakers have not yet done despite being required by law to pass it in February. The House has passed a bill to increase school funding by 3%, but the Senate has not passed any school funding proposal. Legislative leaders said those two issues are dependent on one another and must be decided on together. Both Grassley and Whitfer said they hope to get the funding passed soon. School districts were required to submit their draft budget statements to their county auditor on Friday, despite not receiving concrete funding amounts from the legislature. The failure to deal with this means that many of us may see an increase in our property taxes in our local communities because the state has failed to provide the funding that schools need in order to put their budget together in a very responsible way, said Senate Minority Leader Pam Jochum, Democrat Dubuque, this week. Republican leaders have said further cutting Iowa's income tax is top goal for the session, and lawmakers have started the work on that this year. Reynolds proposed a tax bill this year that would, among other things, set Iowa's individual income tax for this year at a flat 3.65% and lower it to 3.5% in 2025. Reynolds signed a bill in 2022 setting the state's individual income tax on the path to a flat 3.9% by 2023. Republican lawmakers have put forward multiple tax proposals this year, including a proposed constitutional amendment that would require a flat income tax and require a two-thirds vote by the legislature to increase taxes. Whitaker said he wants to accelerate the existing income tax cuts. We have a real opportunity to expedite some of the cuts that we made the last couple of years, whether that's bringing it to the start of 2024 and expedite those cuts to the beginning of the year, or if we start them next year, there's a chance to expedite the cuts we've made, Whitaker said. Democrats have argued that Republicans' recent tax cuts have disproportionately benefited the wealthy and haven't done enough to help low-income Iowans. Jocum, J-O-C-H-U-M, said last week that Republicans should not cut taxes if it will shift the burden for services to property taxes and sales tax. Lawmakers also will need to craft a budget for the upcoming fiscal year before gaveling out of session. State officials projected on Friday that the revenue lawmakers have at their disposal will largely stay the same between this year and next year, increasing by only 0.7%. Democrats said this week they want to see the state get more money towards schools, put more money towards schools, housing, and environmental protections. As we go through this process, we're going to be looking at to see how do these budgets reflect the state's priorities, said House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst. Not the priorities of the Republican governor, the Republican majority, but the priorities of our state. Two major proposals that still are alive after the final deal with improving school safety, including a proposal to create a licensing process for school staff to carry guns on campus. The proposals come in the wake of a shooting at Perry High School in January that killed 11-year-old Amir Jolif, J-O-L-L-I-F, and the school's principal, Dan Marburger. House File 2586, which the House passed, would create a new permitting process that requires training before a school staff member can carry a gun on campus if a school chooses to allow it. Lawmakers hope the bill will ease concerns from insurance companies about insuring schools with armed staff. Another bill would create a grant program that schools can use to purchase guns and training for armed staff. That bill also would provide money for emergency communications, create new building standards, and create a pilot program for gun detection software at school. Both bills are through the House and eligible for consideration in the Senate. There's already things in law to allow for those same safety measures to happen, and so whether we need to make changes or not, that's what our committee will decide over the next few weeks, Whitaker said. Going back to the first page, the last article of A1 sits beneath both of the previous. It's titled, CR makes $5 million emergency repair on pipe at water facility. By Marissa Payne for the Gazette. The city of Cedar Rapids has made emergency repairs that will cost an estimated $5 million on an 84-inch concrete pipe within the water pollution control facility. Utilities Director Roy Hesseman, said this is an internal pipe to the facility near Bertram. During the treatment process, flow from the waste stream comes in a larger 96-inch pipe to the facility's main lift, which pumps it back up to the surface and through a metering structure. That's where the 84-inch pipe starts. This pipe, which needed repairs, takes the waste stream from its initial point of treatment through roughing, filters, domed structures, with arms that rotate inside and distribute wastewater to go through a treatment process that reduces organic matter. A structure in between the pipes provide water to roughing filters. Then it recirculates and material is conveyed to the next section and splits off into a secondary treatment process. Staff noticed a sinkhole on the large pipe in late January or early February, Hestman said. Upon investigation, staff found the inner part of the pipe was highly corroded and had fallen in, which is what he said caused the sinkhole. This article continues to 7A. The pipe corrosion was caused by long-term exposure to corrosive hydrogen sulfide gases, according to city council documents. That's the only pipe to convey that wastewater stream through that section of the plant. So we needed to do something very quickly in order to replace that pipe and make sure that we had full pipe capacity should we get any storm events and higher flows in anything that would create more harm than damage, Hesseman said. The crews began work to replace the pipe last week and wanted to move quickly because of the potential for storms. Hesseman said it was deemed an emergency because of the pipe's critical nature, so staff moved quickly to bring in bypass pumps that would pump around a 900-foot-long section. The contractor excavated out the old pipe and replaced it with a new concrete pipe with high-density polyethylene liner. Hesseman said, so there is much more length of time before anything starts to decay. The pipe is now installed, but Hesseman said there will be some restoration in ancillary, ancillary, ancillary projects associated with a restoration of the underground area. The pipe repair, estimated to cost $5 million, was funded with wastewater department reserves. There are two photos. One is of the pipe being dug up. Another is the pipe a portion of the pipe, hanging from a crane, sort of dangling over the road. That one is titled "Crews Make Emergency Repairs to an 84-inch Pipe at Cedar Rapids Water Pollution Control Facility near Bertram." And then the other photo is captioned "Crews Make Emergency Repairs to an 84-inch Pipe at Cedar Rapids Water Pollution Control Facility." All right. Moving on to page 2, which is the Iowa Today. It's one large article interspersed with a lot of captions and headshots of people. It's titled, "Challengers File to Run for Iowa House Senate." Iowa City incumbent Eleanor Levin draws primary challenger, article by Tom Barton for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, or the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, I apologize. Two Republicans will face off for an open Iowa House seat representing all of Iowa County and parts of Johnson County. And an Iowa City incumbent state representative faces a Democratic primary challenger. Friday was the deadline to qualify for the primary ballot for state and federal offices in Iowa. This year's primary election is June 4th, and the general election is November 5th. Senate 40. State Republican Art Staed, STAED, Democrat Cedar Rapids and former Cedar Rapids City Council member Chris Gullick, a Republican, have filed to run for the Iowa Senate seat, being vacated by Democratic incumbent Todd Taylor. Taylor, who announced his campaign in December for Linn County Auditor, defeated Gullick to win re-election to the Senate seat in 2022. The district covers Robbins, Hiawatha, and parts of the Northwest, Northeast, and Southwest Cedar Rapids. Staed, a former educator and small business owner, is serving his 7th term in the Iowa House, representing a district that encompasses Northeast Cedar Rapids, Hiawatha, and Robbins. I fully intend to continue the work that Senator Taylor has pioneered in the areas of education, labor, workers' rights, justice, and the well-being of Iowa cities, Iowa families, Stiads told the Gazette in December when he announced his candidacy. I want to help rebuild a stronger Iowa with broader prosperity. That, he said, includes supporting early childhood education, a well-funded public education system with well-trained teachers, affordable quality health care and mental health services, a cleaner and safer environment, creating good-paying jobs, and making sure the tax burden is spread in a fair and equitable way for all Iowans. Gullick said his motivations have not changed from when he ran for the Senate 2 years ago, saying Iowa's second-largest metro area needs an independent voice in the Iowa Senate majority. A certified public accountant, Gullick said he feels Iowa Republican lawmakers have let themselves get distracted by some of the minutiae that is out there. He pointed to a host of bills that failed to clear a legislative final deadline this week that he said didn't need to be brought to the tables. The bills deal with everything from banning cruising in the left lane of traffic to prohibiting the Department of Natural Resources from purchasing land at auction to a requirement to honor a patient's request for a known blood donor. Let's spend our time on the more critical issues, education, workforce, and the economy and taxes, Gullick said. A successful educational system is key to retraining and attracting businesses and workforce, Gullick said. Doing so means lawmakers must fund it adequately and apply flexibility for local school and superintendents to make sure they can do what they need to get the best outcomes for their kids, he said. Senate 46. Democrat Ed Chaubel, a longtime public school professional and community advocate, filed paperwork to challenge Republican Senator Don Driscoll of Williamsburg for the state Senate 46th seat. The district includes Washington and Iowa counties and rural portions of Johnson County. Driscoll did not immediately return a message seeking comment. Chaubel of Washington, Iowa, said he was seeking election to give every Iowan the opportunity to send their children to the best public schools possible while ensuring that all of our residents have better quality lives. This means affordable quality child care, access to real first-rate health care in rural Iowa, which includes freedom for women's reproductive health care, clean water, and enhanced recreation opportunities for all generations to enjoy. Chaubel said he was motivated to run for the seat after last year's enactment of a new state's law allowing Iowa families to use public funding to pay for private school tuition and other costs, which Driscoll supported. House 66. A former longtime Republican state lawmaker who made national headlines for switching parties in a rebuke of then-President Donald Trump is running again as a Democrat for House District 66. Former Iowan Republican Andy McKean of Anamosa filed paperwork to run for the Iowa House seat currently held by Republican Steve Bradley. Republican Cascade Bradley, a dentist, is in his second term, having won the seat from McKean in 2020. McKean served 24 years in the Iowa House and Senate and was first elected in 1978. House District 66 includes Jones County and the majority of Jackson County, including Maquoketa, M-A-Q-U-O-K-E-T-A, and the southwestern corner of the country. House 80. Hiawatha City Council member Aim Wichtendahl, W-I-C-H-T-E-N-D-A-H-L, a Democrat and Cedar Rapids veteran John Thompson, a Republican, filed paperwork to run for Iowa House District 80. The district covers Hiawatha, Robbins, and part of Cedar Rapids. State Representative Art Stied, Democrat Cedar Rapids, currently represents the district but is running for Iowa Senate. Which Tyndall, Iowa's first transgender elected official, said sweeping new laws passed last year by Republican lawmakers and signed into law by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds that placed restrictions on LGBTQ students, school materials, and access to abortion, and create new taxpayer-funded private school scholarships prompted her to run for the Iowa House seat. I think something is fundamentally wrong, oh, broken in Des Moines, and it's going to require new leadership to change, which Tyndall told the seat, told the Gazette in December when she announced plans to run. If elected, which Tyndall said she would push to raise the minimum wage, expand access to affordable housing, use the state's budget surplus to create tax credits for childcare, and reverse state laws that placed restrictions on LGBT students, ban nearly all abortions, and provide taxpayer-funded private school scholarships. Thompson serves as president of Salute to the Fallen, a nonprofit he created to help veterans and first responders and their families with mental health issues, homelessness, and more. He also is a member of the Carpenters Union Local 308. Thompson said he enlisted in the U.S. Army in 2007 and was discharged in 2012 due to injuries after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. He moved to Cedar Rapids 8 years ago from Texas and founded Salute to the Fallen in 2019, a nonprofit that provides a crisis intervention hotline and financial assistance to pay for therapy and train service dogs for trauma-related disorders in veterans and first responders. It also helps with food, clothing, and household goods. Thompson said he's running for the Iowa House to better help and be a louder voice for veterans, first responders, and small businesses, and to improve Iowa's mental health care system. House 83. Democrat Kent McNally of Central City filed paperwork Friday to challenge Republican incumbent Representative Cindy Golding and House District 83. The district covers northeast Mount Vernon, Lisbon, Center Point, Central City, Cogan, Palo, Auburnett, and other communities in Linn County. Golding, a rural Linn County filed to run for a second term. A farmer and small business owner, Golding defeated Democratic newcomer Chris Knoll in 2022 to win the seat. House 89. Democratic incumbent Republican Democratic incumbent Representative Eleanor Levin of Iowa City filed to run for a second term to Iowa House District 89. Levin, a writing tutor, was elected in 2022 and 82% of the votes over Republican Jacob Onken. The district covers part of Iowa City and University Heights. She faces Democratic primary challenger Ty Bopp, an assistant store manager at Hy-Vee in Iowa City. Bopp, an Iowa City native and a 2021 graduate of Cornell College with a degree in political science, is pursuing a master's degree in business administration. He said he was motivated to run for the seat out of a desire to increase access to quality community health care, expand tax credits for farmers and renewable energy, and raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour. Levin said she's running to advance legislation that will lower costs, raise wages, and improve the lives of everyday Iowans struggling to afford health care, food, child care, and utility bills. Levin supported legislation that would put the right to collectively bargain in the Iowa Constitution and provide retirement security for more Iowans. In the House, she's also been a vocal advocate for LGBTQ+ Iowans. I ran in the first place because most of the people I know, most of my friends, don't feel like Iowa is a safe and welcoming place for them, Levin said. I don't feel like I'm done yet. There's still a lot of work to do. House 91. Williamsburg Mayor Adam Greer and Judd Lawyer Lawler, L-A-W-L-E-R, of Oxford will face off in a Republican primary for Iowa House District 91, which covers Iowa County in western and northern Johnson County. Democrat Jay Gorsch of Williamsburg also filed for the seat Friday. Republican incumbent Representative Brad Sherman, a pastor from Williamsburg, is not seeking re-election. Sherman has endorsed Lawler. Lawler, a Johnson County native and former federal prosecutor in New York, moved back to Iowa 18 years ago and is a stay-at-home father. If elected, he said, he would be a watchdog for government waste, corruption, and fraud, and continue Sherman's work of strengthening families and protecting individual liberty. Greer was elected mayor of Williamsburg in 2021 and previously served as the city council. He said he is running to maintain home rule, which empowers municipalities, counties, and school boards to govern themselves as much as possible. Whenever possible, local leaders need to be empowered to govern and ultimately be held accountable by their local communities, Greer said in a news release. Government closest to the people governs best. Greer enlisted and served in the Marine Corps during Desert Storm until 1999 and worked in law enforcement in Cedar Rapids. With my experience in local government and law enforcement, I can make sound decisions for our district, he said. House 92. Democratic newcomer and first-time candidate Ann Banowski of Washington, Iowa, has filed to challenge Republican incumbent Heather Hora of rural Washington for House District 92. The district covers all of Washington County and parts of Johnson County. Hora, a farmer in Washington County, was first elected in 2022 and is seeking a second term. She said she welcomes the competition and is running for re-election to continue all the great things House Republicans have done, including passing Reynolds' school choice bill. She also pointed to her support of legislation this year that would limit diversity, equity, inclusion programs at the state's three public universities, increase teacher pay, and overhaul the state's area education agencies. Banowski, a graduate student at the University of Iowa, said she's running to push increased support for education in the state and ensure that public dollars go to public schools. I want to make sure public education is funded, and I want to make sure students have adequate writing and research skills, she said, adding she supports the current organization of AEAs. Before moving on to the third page, I'd like to read the mid-break script. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material held on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. That's 515-243-6833. For A3, the article at the top is titled Cedar Rapids Man Faces Prison in Fatal Assault. Sister of Defendant Whispers Thank You Jesus After Hearing the Verdict. Article by Trish McCaffrey for the Gazette. Cedar Rapids. A judge Friday convicted a Cedar Rapids man of fatally assaulting his 71-year-old mother in 2020, ruling that George Deason understood the consequences of his actions and had a fixed purpose to inflict harm on his mother. Sixth Judicial District Judge Sean McPartland found Deason, 53, guilty of second-degree murder. Deason requested a bench, a non-jury trial, which was held in November. McPartland, who retired last month, read his written ruling Friday in Linn County District Court. Deason faces up to 50 years in prison. He will have to serve a mandatory 35 years before being eligible for parole. Deborah Deason, George's sister who testified at his trial and attended the Friday hearing, whispered, "Thank you, Jesus," when the judge announced the guilty verdict. She and her daughter became emotional as the judge neared the end of reading his conclusions of law in his verdict. She declined to comment after the hearing. McPartland, in his summary, said Deason, beyond reasonable doubt, assaulted Elsie Deason on or about June 30th or June 1st, 2020. At her home, and that she would not have died July 23 but for the assault. The prosecution met its burden of proof by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that Deason acted with malice aforethought at the time of the assault, McPartland said. Dr. Dennis Klein, The chief state medical examiner testified during trial that Elsie Deason died from complications of traumatic brain injury, resulting in pulmonary impulsion in her right lung. Contributing factors to her death were cardiovascular disease and emphysema, he stated. Klein, during trial, also said the injuries to the woman's brain were caused by blunt force trauma, which was confirmed by a neuropathologist at the University of Iowa. A medical intervention to stop brain bleeding meant taking her off a previously prescribed blood thinner, Klein testified. That is, in turn, caused the pulmonary embolism and her death, he concluded. Elsie Deason could have had a heart attack, but if she was on a blood thinner, that would be less likely, he added. The defense admitted Deason assaulted his mother, but argued that her death was caused by an intervening superseding cause of pneumonia and a pulmonary impulsion resulting from the assault, that her conditions developed after she refused medical treatment, food, and physical therapy. Deason's sentencing is set for May 20th. Below this is an article titled, Iowa Revenue Projected to Dip This Year Before a Slight Uptick in 2025. Article by Kayla McCullough for the Gazette. Des Moines. Iowa tax receipts will come in slightly lower than expected this year, but revenues will hold steady in 2025, according to the latest projections from a state panel that estimates annual revenue. The projections are critical as state lawmakers begin the work of crafting a budget for the upcoming fiscal year, using the projections by the Revenue Estimating Conference to determine how much they can spend. Income tax cuts for individuals and corporations will continue to drive down revenue from those sources, but state officials expect increasing consumer spending to increase revenues from sales tax. The panel, which met Friday, expects Iowa's total revenue to be $9.63 billion this year, a decrease of about $219 million from last year, and about $120 million lower than state officials estimated in December. In fiscal 2025, which begins July 1st, revenue is beginning to reach $9.7 billion, an increase on about 0.7% from 2024. That number would be down about $100 million from 2022, when lawmakers enacted income tax cuts that put Iowa on a path to a flat 3.9% tax rate in 2026. State lawmakers will need to use the panel's last projection from December when deciding how to spend the state's tax dollars, because state law requires the lower of the two estimates to be used to create the budget. The 2025 estimate in December was $9.64 billion. Iowa Department of Manager Director Craig Paulson, who sits on the estimating board representing the governor's office, said conservative spending by the Republican-led state government has put Iowa in a strong financial position. Paulson said there is room to further cut taxes, which Iowa's GOP leaders have called for. Thanks to this fiscal restraint, we think there is no reason to think the state cannot continue down the path of leaving more money in Iowans' pockets, Paulson said. In 2026, the projection gets more uncertain, as two more state agencies were nearly $1 billion apart in their initial projections for that year's income. The Department of Management and the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency each submit projections ahead of the board's quarterly meetings, and the panel has to reach the two. The Department of Management predicted a 3.5% revenue increase between 2025 and 2026, while just Legislative Services Agency predicted a 5.4% reduction. The panel eventually settled on a 1% decrease estimate, which would put revenue that year at $9.6 billion. Paulson said he expects a larger increase as the economy continues to grow. Jennifer Acton, the Fiscal Services Director for the Legislative Services Agency, said she expects recent tax cuts and more refunds because of the way corporations are taxed to drag down the state's revenue. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the Friday estimates show that Iowa is in a solid financial position.
even with the significant national economic challenges created by so-called Bidenomics, Iowa's economy remains strong and steady, she said in a statement provided by a spokesperson. Reynolds has proposed a bill that would accelerate the 2022 tax cuts and reach a lower tax rate faster. Under Reynolds' proposal, Iowa taxpayers would pay a flat 3.5% income tax starting in 2025. Reynolds has proposed spending $8.9 billion from the state's general fund in next year's budget, which would represent a 4.7% spending increase from the 2024 budget. The state ended 2023 with a $1.83 billion budget surplus. The state's taxpayer relief fund, which is used to fund tax cuts, is estimated to reach $3.68 billion this fiscal year, according to Reynolds' budget recommendation. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican Grimes, said the projection show the success of Republicans' fiscal policy in cutting income taxes. Our agenda has resulted in a strong Iowa economy, a balanced budget, almost $4 billion in the taxpayer relief fund, and a surplus this year of roughly $1 billion. Whitfer said in a statement, "Now is the time to continue to implement these policies," and Senate Republicans look forward to building on our success this year with the House and Governor Reynolds to enhance the truly great condition of our state. In written statements, legislative Democrats criticized Republicans for failing to pass a school funding plan despite the legal deadline passing in February. Lawmakers have not passed a budget for state aid schools as they continue to work out a controversial policy to overhaul the state's area education agencies. Representative Timmy Brown Powers of Waterloo, the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee, said the legislature should be pursuing an agenda that funds public schools and increases Iowans' wages. "We believe it's time to make public schools our top priority again," she said in a statement. Today's budget estimate confirms there is no fiscal reason for GOP lawmakers to continue stalling funding for public schools. It's just all politics for them. As we learn again this week with 1,200 Iowans losing their jobs in Perry, more tax giveaways to corporations and the richest Iowans don't give Iowans the wages or job security they deserve. Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat Des Moines, said in a statement that lawmakers should focus on passing a budget over divisive social policies. "We owe it to our constituents to fund our public schools, pass a balanced and responsible state budget, and then adjourn for the year," said Peterson, the ranking member on the Senate Budget Committee. "Iowans aren't asking for more politics and culture wars. They're asking for a government that does its job." Moving to page 4, this is Nation and World. The top headline is titled, "Prosecutor Leaves Georgia Election Case. Judge Ruled Here District Attorney Must Leave in Trump Trial," article by the Associated Press. Atlanta. A special prosecutor who had a romantic relationship with Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis formally withdrew Friday from the Georgia election interference case against Donald Trump after a judge ruled he had to leave or Willis couldn't continue to pursue the charges. Attorney Nathan Wade's resignation allows Willis to remain on the most brawling of four criminal cases against the presumptive Republican nominee in the 2024 presidential election. But the long-term damage to the public perception of the prosecution remains unclear, particularly in light of Trump's relentless barrage of attacks on the pair, who pledged to hold Trump accountable but found their own actions under public microscope. Wade offered his resignation in a letter to Willis, saying he was doing so in the interest of democracy and dedication to the American public and to move this case forward as quickly as possible. "I'm sure that the case and the team will be in good hands moving forward and justice will be served," Wade wrote. Willis complimented Wade's professionalism and dignity in a letter accepting his resignation, effective immediately. She said he had endured She said he had endured threats against himself and his family, as well as unjustified attacks in the media and in court on his reputation as a lawyer. Trump's team felt differently. In a social media post, Trump said the Fannie Willis lover had resigned in disgrace, and Trump repeated his assertion that the case is an effort to hurt his campaign to reclaim the White House in November. Trump has denied doing anything wrong and pleaded not guilty. An attorney for the former president said they respected the court's decision that believed the judge did not afford appropriate significance to the prosecutorial misconduct of Willis and Wade. Defense attorneys said could try to appeal the ruling, but they would need the judge's permission to do so. In a separate criminal case against Trump in New York, a judge agreed Friday to delay the trial related to hush money payments during Trump's 2016 campaign until at least mid-April. The trial was supposed to begin later this month, but Trump's lawyers said they needed more time to sift through evidence that they only recently obtained from a previous federal investigation into the matter. In Georgia, Wade's resignation came hours after Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McCaffrey said he had to be removed or Willis must step aside from the case. McCaffrey did not find that Willis's relationship with Wade amounted to a conflict of interest, but said the allegations created an appearance of impropriety that infected the prosecution team. As the case moves forward, reasonable members of the public could easily be left to wonder whether the financial exchanges have continued despite As the case moves forward, reasonable members of the public could easily be left to wonder whether the financial exchanges have continued resulting in some form of benefit to the district attorney, or even whether the romantic relationship has resumed, the judge wrote. Put differently, an outsider could reasonably think that the district attorney is not exercising her independent professional judgment, totally free of any compromising influences. As long as Wade remains on the case, this unnecessary perception will persist. Friday's extraordinary developments underscored the extent to which the case that began with allegations that a former president tried to undermine the will of the people who voted him out of the White House had become consumed by talk of the love lives of its top prosecutors. In accepting Wade's resignation, Willis made clear her determination to turn the page from weeks of embarrassing headlines about romantic getaways, sex, and stashes of cash that have dominated coverage of the case. Willis hired Wade in 2021 to lead the team to investigate and ultimately prosecute Trump and 18 others on charges that they illegally tried to overturn his narrow loss to Democrat Joe Biden in Georgia in 2020. The case uses a statute normally associated with mobsters to accuse the former president, lawyer, and other aides of a criminal enterprise to keep him in power. Below this is an article titled, "Russia Election Holds Little Suspense After Putin Has Crushed All Dissent," article by the Associated Press. Russia began 3 days of voting Friday in a presidential election that is all but certain to extend President Vladimir Putin's rule for 6 more years after he stifled dissent. At least half a dozen cases of vandalism at polling stations were reported, including a firebombing, several people pouring green liquid into ballot boxes, an apparent nod to the late opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who in 2017 was attacked by an assailant splashing green disinfectant in his face. Voting is taking place through Sunday at polling stations across the vast country's 11 time zones, in illegally annexed regions of Ukraine and online. Putin cast his ballot online, according to the Kremlin. The election comes against the backdrop of a ruthless crackdown that has crippled independent media and prominent rights groups and given Putin full control of the political system. It also comes as Moscow's war in Ukraine enters its third year. Russia has the advantage on the battlefield, where it is making small, if slow, gains. A Russian missile strike on the port city of Odessa killed at least 14 people on Friday, local officials said. Ukraine, meanwhile, has made Moscow look vulnerable behind the front line, with drone attacks deep inside Russia and high-tech drone assaults that put its Black Sea fleet on the defensive. Russian regions bordering Ukraine reported a spike in shelling and repeated attacks this week by Ukrainian forces, while Putin described Friday as an attempt to frighten residents and derail the vote. Those enemy strikes haven't been and won't be left unpunished, he vowed at a meeting of his Security Council. I'm sure that our people, the people of Russia, will respond to that with even greater cohesion, Putin said. By the time polls closed Friday night at Russia's westernmost region of Kaliningrad, more than a third of the country's eligible voters had cast ballots in person and online, according to the Central Election Commission. The election holds little suspense since Putin, 71, is running for his fifth term virtually unchallenged. His political opponents are either in jail or in exile. Navalny, the fiercest of them, died in an Arctic penal colony last month. The three other candidates on the ballot are low-profile politicians from token opposition parties that support the Kremlin's line. Observers have little to no expectation the election will be free and fair. European Council President Charles Michel mordantly commented Friday on the vote's preordained nature. Would like to congratulate Vladimir Putin on his landslide victory in the election starting today. No opposition, no freedom, no choice, he wrote on X, formerly Twitter. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I'd like to once again say that if you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833.